Blog Talk Radio.
And greetings. Welcome to another segment of New Day Resurrection and Liberation. We are going to continue some of the dialogue from last week. We were having some technical difficulties, and so we're just going to kind of go into what we were going to talk about last week, which, of course, was to have an interview or a dialogue with the sister who has written a new book called Blue Suede Shoes. And that sister's name, of course, is Sister Teresa Stovell. She, along with I think three other sisters, have written a book, and it focuses on, of course, some of the issues that we've been talking about regarding violence and abuse of our women and girls. And so they've put some information as well as some insight into that issue, but done so in a very creative, artistic kind of way. I'm sure you're going to find the dialogue very informative, and we're looking forward to having her on very shortly. Of course, before we begin, we always give thanks and praises to our Creator, and we are always very cognizant and appreciative of our freedom-fighting ancestors. As I said earlier, we are going to go into continuing the observance of Women's History Month, and certainly we are going to focus on the continuation of the great legacies of our women, of Black women from antiquity to present day. Another thing that we're going to talk about tonight is, of course, what's going on in Libya. You know, as of a little while ago, we learned that not only is France, but Britain and the United States have now imposed themselves upon Libya. Our last report indicates that over 100 missiles have already hit Libya. They came directly from France, I believe, but now the United States and Britain have also applied military tactics. So we're going to talk a little bit about that tonight, and giving us a report and also an overview regarding why some of this has happened is going to be Dr. James Smalls. Dr. James Smalls, of course, is a well-known historian, scholar, activist, and freedom fighter. And we were fortunate enough to have some dialogue with him earlier today. And what we decided to do, because this situation is so complex, we decided that tomorrow we're going to have a special broadcast at 3 o'clock. And that special broadcast is going to focus specifically on the issue in Libya. Professor Smalls has some information that he wants to share with us that he has been made privy to. And, of course, we're going to open the lines up so that you are able to communicate with us tomorrow to give your opinion as well as, just share your thoughts about what you think is going on in Libya and why this has an impact on us as people of African descent. So with that said, we're going to make sure that we keep you updated and abreast as best as possible, because we know that in the U.S., the news and information that we tend to get here is not only tainted, but oftentimes very misleading. So it's always good to be able to have access to some sources that, brings us more clarity and certainly information that is definitely more relevant and more accurate in our best interest as a people. So again, tomorrow at 3 o'clock, we advise you to tune in to New Day Resurrection and Liberation. We're going to have a special edition, and that edition is going to focus on what's going on in the northern part of Africa. We're going to talk about Libya in particular, but we're going to also talk about the call for a million woman march in Egypt. Yes, women in Egypt are very much preparing themselves to stand up and to fight for their kind of less oppressive modes of being. And in doing so, they have decided to call themselves a million woman march. And we, of course, have made preparations to begin dialoguing with some of the sisters, some of the women who are of Egypt. We want to make sure that they know that as the original Million Women March, we certainly support any type of things that is about the upliftment of women of African descent in particular. So, you know, we look forward to connecting and building in some way. But we just found it very interesting that they wanted to kind of model themselves after such a historic gathering here in the United States. And it's so ironic how, unfortunately, sisters here in the United States have not really stepped up in the way that we had hoped. But you will get the opportunity again, because come October, when we begin to deal with our 14-year anniversary celebration, we will begin to officially put the Men Women Movement into an international arena. We've already began that process. And, of course, come next year for October, our plan is to hold the first Africana Women's Power Summit in Africa next year. And it will be one of more than probably at least five summits that will be held on an international level, including Latin America and possibly Europe. So, you know, we have a lot that's getting ready to be brought to the table. I just came from an exciting meeting, and I want to thank Brother Tyson and Brother Percy for the meeting that we had earlier, which we'll tell you more about that very soon. But for those sisters who are interested in investment and other wealth-building kinds of opportunities, well, I can tell you, we've got some things for you, and it's going to happen very, very soon. So I want to give you more information about that before we leave tonight's program. But we're going to get ready to go to our live line. And as we said earlier, one of the major kinds of focuses that we are going to have is that of violence and abuse of our women and girls. Over the course of the past couple of months in particular, we've gotten a lot of information and reports and, you know, done quite a bit of what one may call networking to begin addressing this issue a bit more, not only proactively, but realistically. And I personally have been blessed to connect with some sisters in particular from Texas, from New York, Florida, Virginia, California. I mean, these sisters have really stepped up, and a few brothers too, I may say. And in doing so, have began to really put together what we envisioned is actually happening, and that's a national task force to begin to really focus on the specific issues of violence and abuse of our women and girls, both cause and effect, and needless to say, solutions. So every week there is a telephone conference call that takes place, a telephone conference meeting, shall I say, that takes place every Wednesday night from 8. Usually we go until 11 o'clock, believe it or not, and we've made such great accomplishments. Now, one of the sisters who has been joining us on that telephone conference meeting is about to come on now. Again, we're going to talk with a sister who is an author, an activist, and a sister who is about, you know, getting this stuff not only done, but making certain that we have a certain type of stability and longevity as we proceed. And this is what, you know, all of the people who are coming on board, this is what we are focusing on it to do. And that is to really make certain that we reduce and then ultimately eliminate violence and abuse of our women and girls. And note again, we are not talking about just domestic violence. We are also talking about mental and spiritual abuse. But we'll go into those areas a bit more at another time. But what we're going to do right now is we're going to get ready to go to our live line. And joining us again is an author, an activist, a sister who really has her kind of finger on the pulse of what is going on with our women as it comes to this issue in terms of, you know, how we've got to begin to look at this further. And again, this book that this sister and a few other sisters have co-authored, My Blue Suede Shoes, you know, even the name of it is catchy, and especially when it comes to women, because women definitely are about getting, you know, a collection of shoes. I mean, let's be honest about it. Most of our sisters have a relatively large collection or variety, shall I say, of shoes. And in reality, again, that is very significant in terms of, to some degree, how we feel, you know, when it comes to that external thing that we do on a day-to-day basis. These are the external expressions of how we think and how we feel. So this sister has been able to, from an artistic standpoint, take a very you know, important and touchy subject and begin to approach it in such a way that we can not only grasp it, examine it, but begin to also look at it so that we have a better understanding, which, of course, will allow us to create some potential or better solutions. So that said, we're going to go to our live line. And joining us tonight is Sister Teresa Stovell, who again is one of the authors of a new book that will be released officially March 26th, I believe. And it will certainly be available to you, and she's going to tell us how you can obtain it. And again, we're going to go to our live line, and joining us to talk about the book, My Blue Suede Shoes, and, of course, the issue of violence and abuse. We're going to now talk with Sister Teresa. Sister Teresa, are you there?
Hello, Empress. How are you?
Oh, great, great. Good, thanks. It's good to hear you again today.
Yes, it's wonderful to be here. Greetings to everyone.
All right, all right. So before we talk about the book, please tell us a little bit about you.
Oh, okay. Well, my name is Teresa, and I'm an author and a blogger, and I've been a writer really my whole life. And I've had a few books published, different kinds of books, some nonfiction, some fiction, and blessed to be, you know, published, which is not always easy to do. So I feel really blessed and fortunate. And in having different kinds of writing opportunities, I enjoy all kinds of writing, Empress, but what I learned is that I really like writing fiction with a mission. And the fiction with a mission, the first opportunity I had to really, really do that was with co-authors Tracy Price Thompson and Desiree Cooper and Elizabeth Atkins. And we had a book that came out, I think it was 3 or 4 years ago, called Other People's Skin. And it was the first in what we call the Sister for Sister Empowerment Series. And Other People's Skin was 4 novellas, a novella being kind of a short novel or a long short story. You know, however you want to look at it, it's really a long, short story. Dealing with, in that case, in the first book, we dealt with the skin-hair tensions between African-American women. And we wanted to have, we're very different authors, we're very different people, we have very different writing styles. We wanted to have something, we had very different stories that we wrote. We wanted to have something that tied them together. And so in that case, we wanted an item that was a catalyst for healing, because these books are written to look at how we can heal from different crises and issues facing the African-American community. So in the first book, it was a brown hat, like a men's fedora hat,
right.
And that was appeared in each of the very different stories. The stories weren't connected to each other at all. They were, each was completely, you know, on its own. So we wanted to continue this, and so for my blue suede shoes, we picked a pair of blue suede shoes, although in each, what's different is that in this book, you know, we had so much fun with it that each of us has a different kind of blue suede shoes in our story, but each of the 4 stories has a pair of blue suede shoes that, again, is the catalyst for the main character's healing. So that's where the title came from, and like you said, we wanted to keep it kind of, you know, interesting. In this case, it's kind of a fashion focus, but this is, again, fiction with a mission.
Right. Wonderful, wonderful. So, okay, tell us a little bit more about the book. I mean, what inspired you to write specifically about the issue of violence and abuse?
It's an issue that we know is very prevalent. And we are all in our different ways in our different lives, that we have the 4 of us, all activists in different ways through our writing and in our communities. And it's something that we were quickly able to agree, you know, is unfortunately very prevalent and ongoing. And it's an issue that, as we all know, it affects everyone. not just the victims, not just the perpetrators, but everyone. You know, if there's a ripple effect, and, you know, obviously in a family, if there are children, they're affected directly or indirectly, whether they're physically abused, emotionally, verbally. And in society, there's a ripple effect, too. And one of the things that each of our stories ends up touching on in some way is the cycle of abuse. It tends to go, as you know, through generations, through families. It gets embedded into cultures as normal, you know, or seen as normal. And so that it's not, the personal becomes political, the personal becomes communal and affects a community, a neighborhood, a nation, you could argue, you know. And there's so much abuse. It just seems as though it's increasing nowadays, which I find very disturbing. But it just seems like there's so much of it. It's almost like a tsunami of it. And I think because we're in the information age, we have social media, we're more aware of things that happen around the world that we might not otherwise know about. Mm-hmm. So it was our awareness that this is something that touches, directly or indirectly, it really touches all of us.
Absolutely. So what did you have to do, not have to do, but did you do any, like, research, or was this just from some general observation, or, you know, something that you saw in your personal life? How were you able to really kind of tap into it the way that you did?
Well, two things. My story was assigned to me. Tracy Price Thompson and I are co-editors of the book. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of the bossier one on the first book, because the skin hair thing is an issue I've been, you know, really outspoken about publicly all my life, or most of my life. And so I think that we came up with this topic that we wanted to all address, and it was a phone conference call with the four of us. And we've all never been in the same room at the same time. Like, we've all never been physically together. We still haven't all met each other in person. Mm-hmm. Isn't that funny? It's our second book. But anyway, and so we were talking, and Tracy said, Teresa, I want you to write about a woman who beats her man.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my first response was not very evolved. My first response was, you're joking, right? I mean, you know, that doesn't happen. Who would care about that? What you know? But I said, but the writer in me loved the challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I had the split reaction. I just started laughing. I was like, okay, Tracy, you know, you really want to give me a challenge. So when we ended the phone call, I just kind of sat there going, this is crazy. So, you know, I hit Google. My best friend is Google, and I started learning, and I started talking to people, and of course, I learned what we now know much more widely. This was 3 or 4 years ago, is that female-on-male violence in relationships is just as common as male-on-female. It's not reported as often. And just because of the logistics that most of the time the guy is stronger and bigger, you know, it's not devastating in the same physical way as often, and women don't kill their intimate partners nearly as often. But it happens to be very prevalent, which completely shocked me. That completely shocked me. I was still kind of skeptical. But I did my research, and then I started talking to women I know, including women in my family. We're like, yeah, I've hit my, you know. And that really fascinated me. So I had to open my own mind. I had to get past my own prejudices, my own biases, because, you know, my father was a batterer, and he never battered my brother or me, and my mother said he never hit her, so I believe her. They split up when I was very young. But he was, and he battered the wife he ended up staying with the rest of his life, and he was a very, very abusive person.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was aware of kind of the energy or the vibe of abuse. There's an energy that comes with it, you know.
Right.
And some of the dynamics of it, although I didn't witness it firsthand much. But he was also, as is often the case, very emotionally and verbally abusive to everybody. He was equal opportunity with that. And there was just a lot of abuse in the environment, different kinds. I mean, back in the day, we didn't have language for it, so we couldn't talk about it. We couldn't articulate it. We couldn't name it. But the energy of it was there, okay? Mm-hmm. And the fallout was there. And the ripple effect that I'm talking about was there.
Right.
And even though you didn't always know what you were looking at, you knew what it felt like, even if it wasn't happening to you directly, if that makes any sense. And so, you know, you just kind of, it was like this cloud or something. So I was familiar with the energy of it. Yeah, I was familiar with the energy of it. And I made up my mind at a very young age, well, no guy will ever hit me. You know, so it was prevalent enough. And something else I remember is I had two girlfriends, one who's, two of us had divorced mothers, single mothers, and the other had, you know, parents who were married. And we were adolescents. And I remember them both saying to me, both African-American, both with straight faces, very serious. This was like a middle working class neighborhood. That if a guy doesn't hit you, he doesn't love you. If a man doesn't, if, you know, if a guy, if a boy, a man, whatever, we were 11, 12, 13, doesn't hit you, he doesn't love you. That concept. Now, I had already made up my mind before then, before I even met them, that, you know, nobody's ever going to hit me. So we argued for years over that. For years. But they were, that was to them like one of the Ten Commandments. I mean, there was no distinct. They believed that as fundamentally as they believed anything else in life at that stage.
Wow.
I don't, you know, and it's a popular, it's a popular concept, and I don't think it's limited to the African American community. But I don't, you know, I don't know. But I was tripping, as we used to say. I was like, "Are you kidding? Are you crazy?" I would be very upset with them. Like, no, that's not love. But I, you know, I didn't have a lot of language to articulate with them back then. And but think about that. And there are still people, if he doesn't hit you, he doesn't love you.
Mm-hmm.
But what does that let you know? That lets you know that the norm for them included some physical abuse.
Right.
Right?
Right.
That was normalized, and so that was seen as not just normalized, but if he wasn't doing it, something was wrong.
Right.
He didn't
right.
care for you. And right? So that's kind of, you know, as that always stayed with me, and I was always very frustrated and saddened by that to this day. But it's, I know that a lot of people believe that because that's their experience. You know, with Chris Brown or Rihanna, the first thing that I was looking for when that story broke, and it came out pretty early, is they had both come from homes where the man had beat the woman. So we're all mad at Chris Brown, right? But they're two. Also, they're kids.
Mm-hmm.
They're kids, what, 18, 19, 20, 21 years old?
Right.
Right?
Right.
But again, that was normal behavior in their life experience in their homes of origin, their families of origin. Not to justify, not to say it's right, but I think, you know, I think it's important when we look at these kinds of horrific behaviors when we can, Empress, that we try to understand the root causes.
You have just said so much there. That is, to me, Sister, where some of this has kind of gone awry, meaning I often hear about different things happening with the issue, especially, you know, other people. But rarely do I really hear going to the extent of looking at why is this happening.
Mm-hmm. Right, because we can't stop it unless we understand the root cause. You can't. I mean, again, Chris Brown, you know, and I'm not judging one way or the other, but Miles Davis beat Cecily Tyson, locked her in the basement, didn't affect his career.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there have been other famous black men. Okay, so the outcry against him and the, you know, his career was derailed. I don't know if he's making a comeback or whatever. The point being, though, that he was villainized. Now, in some ways, though, I thought that marked progress because in the court of public opinion in the African American community, he was very quickly criticized, very harshly criticized, you know, and by men as well as women, almost by men more than women. Which I found interesting because I hadn't experienced that when other celebrities had, you know, Mike Tyson.
Right. Yes.
When they had, you know, yeah, I beat her, yeah, I raped her, yeah, I, you know. And he seemed to also show remorse. But again, so I think in a way that's a clumsy kind of progress. But again, you can't, you with this kind of dysfunction, I think you really have to look at where does it originate? You know,
right.
Again, if this is normal to someone, right? But this is normal to someone, you know, it's like the color purple, right? The color purple. And there's so much abuse, but then the story is ultimately about, you know, growth and redemption and forgiveness and all that,
yeah.
And love,
right.
Even. But there's so much abuse, but there's so much abuse in so many things. I mean, God, you know, sitting through the film version of For Colored Girls, where all these poems that we grew up with were made visual and were interpreted for us,
mm-hmm.
I felt like I'd been in the ring with Mike Tyson after that movie. And it wasn't a bad experience. I was just like, oh, my God. Right? I mean, I knew every single word of the choreo poem because I grew up with it. But to see it, you know, brought to a different dimension and everything, I was like, oh, that is absolutely and utterly emotionally and psychologically exhausting. You know,
yeah.
So again, what makes people do things? What, you know, so with intimate partner violence, so my story is called Breaking Dishes. And ironically, you're going to like this. I wrote this a year and a half, 2 years before the Chris Brown Rihanna incident. And a girlfriend of mine I don't even know the name of the CD. I do have to research that so I can sound a little more knowledgeable. But it's a Rihanna CD that came out. We were in her car, her new car, and she was playing it for me. And she said, this is an interesting song. What do you think of this? And it's called Breaking Dishes.
Yeah.
And I don't know if anybody's ever heard it, but I had written the story already. But then I heard this song, and I went back and I renamed the song after it was originally The Cleanup Woman, which is another interesting story about Betty Rose. So the name of it was The Cleanup Woman. But I changed it to Breaking Dishes after I heard that song. And I have some of the lyrics there. And it's a song where Rihanna's saying, I'm going to fight a man tonight. And this is long before the Chris Brown incident. But so that became like the theme song for the story because it's about a woman who beats a man. You know, her man, she beats her husband. So the woman in the story, the main character is Monique Worthington, and she's a news anchor. She and her husband, Armstrong Worthington, live in Atlanta, very successful, you know, couple. He is the head of the city council, and he wants to run for mayor of Atlanta. So that's where the story kind of starts. Well, Armstrong is, and I had to ask two questions. And when you write fiction, you always start with a question. Right,
mm-hmm.
And then the writing of it and the creation of the story is your attempt to answer the question and interpret it in a way that's hopefully entertaining. So I had to make these people real, and I was still kind of like, what kind of? So I said, well, what kind of woman beats her man, and what kind of man lets her?
Mm-hmm.
So that was what everything grew out of. So Armstrong is very powerful alpha male, and he's the head of this, and he wants to be the mayor, and he cheats on his wife. They don't have any kids. He cheats on his beautiful wife, and she beats him. Now, when she beats him, she's not causing him severe physical trauma because she's way smaller than he is.
Mm-hmm.
But she beats him, and he's completely passive. He completely closes down and just lets her.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then he starts, when she gets to a certain point, he starts verbally taunting her. Okay? So there's a lot of cruelty, right? But some people would argue that cheating on your mate is a form of abusing your mate
mm-hmm.
emotionally,
mm-hmm.
mentally, right? Psychologically.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to look at these people. And they really love each other. There are some good aspects
mm-hmm.
to their marriage. And then, so when she finds out he's cheating, she goes off, and then it escalates, you know, from there. It turns out he's this woman, and she's pregnant. That's all I'm going to say. And she confronts Monique. Ivy is his girlfriend's name. She confronts Monique with some devastating news, and then the drama escalates from there. But again, I wanted to look at two very simple questions. What kind of woman beats her man? What would make her beat her man? And Monique's justification in her brain is, this is how you fight for your marriage.
Wow.
You know, I went to college. You're gonna like this. I went to college with this is an African American woman who was dating an Ethiopian guy, right? And he was really cute. that hot, and the ladies really liked him. She was a sister. I grew up from Seattle. She was from Chicago. So she was a little more, I don't know, she had a little more swag than, you know, Pacific Northwest sisters.
Mm-hmm.
And she was constantly beating up the girls he cheated with. And I would be like, are you an idiot? What's wrong with you? And going back to him.
Wow.
She would beat the girls up. A couple of them she put in the hospital. And then she would sit with her man. I mean, and I said to her, how many can you beat up? But nothing I said made any sense to her. So I thought of her when I was writing it. Like, she never beat him up, right? But her justification was, I'm fighting for my relationship. And she really believed that. I had to respect that she really believed that. I thought her behavior choices were insane, right? But I came to understand that that was real for her. Do you see what I mean, Empress?
Right. Sure.
Fighting for my relationship, and she literally was. I mean, he eventually left her, and I'm sure he continued to cheat on whoever he was with. You know, I have no idea. You know what I'm saying? But I thought of her, too. Her name was Marilyn. I thought of her, too, when I was creating this story. I had to, you know, because that, I never got over that. She beat up in the short time I knew her, like, I don't know, 10 girls, you know. The guy was a major dog, you know. And I would say that, you know, he's a dog. I mean, come on, idiot, you know. But I was like, you could beat him up, you could leave him. Why do you keep beating him? I guess she thought eventually she could just, they would stop.
Right.
But they never did, because it was all emanating from him. So part of this is, I think each of the stories, I want to tell you about the other three stories too, are really kind of the crimes people commit in the name of love in intimate relationships.
Mm-hmm.
They're not all marital relationships. Mine is, and then Elizabeth is about a couple who's engaged. And her story, which is called The Wrong Side of Mr. Right, is about a high-powered attorney who becomes engaged to the man of her dreams. And he's very subtly verbally and emotionally abusive. Because nobody ever talks about that. And you can't go to the police.
Right.
Okay?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You can never take that to court. You can't get a restraining order.
Right.
Mm-hmm. On verbal, psychological, mental abuse. So very subtle, and Elizabeth did a beautiful job with that. Tracy's story, Brotherly Love, is real rough. there's two main characters. There's a social worker who comes in contact and tries to help a real smart, street-tough girl, teenage girl who's got some family problems. And her abuse emanates out of her family.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Out of her family. And it's a really strong story. It's a very strong story. And then Desiree Cooper's Breaking It Down is about a talk show host who beats her daughter.
Mm.
Who beats her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we tried to look at really keep a lot of variety in the overall book.
Yes.
And look at, you know, but what makes people beat their children? And, you know, as you know, a couple generations ago, that was par for the course. Now it's considered child
right.
abuse.
Right.
There's some people, there's still, especially in the African American community, ongoing debates. And there's no consensus about beating children. Right?
Mm-hmm.
There is no consensus whatsoever about beating children.
Right. Although now the system has a little spin in it, you know, because with the way that things are going throughout this country, if you reprimand your child physically, it could have you ending up in court. And I'm not talking about anything really, you know, excessive or anything like that. I mean,
well, yeah,
kids
exactly.
Now have a way of wanting to infringe, you know, upon, especially our people. I'm starting to see more and more of our women caught up in this maze that's called the judicial system.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like all across the board, because the bottom line is, and going back to what we're talking about in terms of women being abused, the bottom line really is to get access to the children. Okay, that's really what is going on, because as we talked, I think, briefly on one of our recent telephone conference meetings, we're now hearing how courts are taking children from women who are going through abusive relationships.
Mm-hmm.
See, so this whole thing is starting to manifest in a different kind of way, which I've always said, for a while anyway, that to me the objective for the system is really about getting access to the children.
Well, I think you got two sides, and I don't think you can look at one side without the other, so you make a really good point. I think the other side is it's just the very first infant kind of steps in this country for the system to even consider ways in which to protect children. Now the problem, it's problematic because there are a lot of problems. Number one, what happens with the kid is the kid goes into foster care, which there's only a slight chance that that's going to be better for them.
Right.
Okay,
right.
That they're not going to also be abused in the same or another or more ways. Okay,
right.
So that's not like a safe haven. So I think part of the problem is that you're right, that systemically, if we take race out of it for children overall, on the one hand, and we know there's always, you know, there's always glitches and things. And so what happens, you know, my children are teenagers now, but, you know, mm-hmm. when they first went, like, to daycare or to school, and people are hyper, hyper vigilant. And now, as you know, teachers, doctors, therapists, officers of the law, anybody who even suspects a child is being abused has to report. Attorneys, anybody, has to, counselors,
mm-hmm.
it has to. They're required
right.
by law to report any suspicion of abuse. So what happens is, while there may be good intentions, you know, overall and on individuals' parts, well, what else can we do, right? Because what you have is so many children experiencing so many kinds of abuse. So I think that our efforts are clumsy, flawed, imperfect, systemically, right? Whether to get their hands on black children, yes, but it just overall, but the spirit of it, I think, represents at least a more evolved position than in the past. Now, you still got, however, several schools, particularly in the southern states, where spanking is still allowed. So, I mean, again, it's a debate that I say, it's like gun control, capital punishment, and abortion. People believe what they believe, and they're never going to change their minds. I mean, you believe what you believe, and it's not something I find even worth debating with people, because people stand where they stand. And it's like, well, I turned out good because I was beaten, or I turned out good because I wasn't beaten. And those are the only two positions people really have.
Mm-hmm,
okay?
Mm-hmm.
Or I beat my kids, or I don't beat my kids, and they're fine. So, again, those are the really, if you break it down, right, those are the only two positions. I mean, there's variations on the themes, but those are the core themes you get back to. I was beaten, and so that made me turn out better.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting, though, is that research shows that the vast majority of people who are in prison experience some kind of childhood abuse, often sexual, but some kind of childhood abuse, and were beaten as children. So, you know, because black people say, well, that's why I'm not in jail. So, you know, again, the popular culture, the legal system, as you're saying, which is inherently racist, and you're right, out, you know, institutionally kind of evil in many ways. We got the cradle of prison pipeline, like you said, to get us in the system, You got all those things going on. And you say, well, but is it better? Is it better that we're at least, some children are getting some kind of, there's at least now language. I think if we, you know, if we could fast forward 100 years, 200 years in the future, we look back on, like we do on many things, and look at how clumsy and imperfect our efforts are. I would still argue, though, that the spirit of the efforts, not on a systemic basis in terms of the system trying to get our kids, but on a smaller, more human scale, is probably an improvement. because at least we're hyper-vigilant. Now, of course, there's going to be downsides and mistakes made and things like that. But when I was growing up, there was nothing. There was nowhere for any child to go. There were no protections anywhere. There was no institutional acknowledgement. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And there was no haven for kids.
Mm-hmm.
So things are really jacked up at home, and you're just a kid trying to survive. At least today, right, you can go to a teacher, a counselor, a something, and say, hey,
mm-hmm.
you know, look at these bruises. Whereas, you know, 40 years ago, 30 years ago, nothing would have happened. The child
right.
wouldn't even have thought to show the bruises to anybody. Because what good would that? Do you see what I mean? So
yeah.
I think like everything else, yeah, it's not perfect, but I think it's something we've got to grapple with. We've got to continue to grapple with.
And I definitely can see, I can see that really. The thing that kind of bothers me is that what I feel we need to do on our parts, even in understanding that kind of perhaps improvement in one way. See, to me, a system of this nature is always going to demonstrate some form of progress. That's how it's designed. This thing we call democracy and whatever is designed to show some kind of continual advancement or some form of advancement over a period of time. Well, certainly, advancement is going to occur in any so-called civilized society. That's just the nature of societies, and given that things progress, technology progresses, populations progress, this and that progress. So, needless to say, improvements are going to seem to be improved because that's just the nature of the way societies, and especially a so-called social or democratic society, they're going to show, you know, some forms of improvement. Well, now, I think, though, it behooves us to examine that closer in that improvement for who, to what extent, in reality, you see. So as I agree very much with what you're saying, because, yes, there are now apparatuses whereby things can be reported and so forth and so on. But the flip side of that is, how is this being orchestrated? Now, if I may sound like I'm somewhat pessimistic of the system, then you're right, I am, having observed this for all my life and looking at some of the time before me, I'm very pessimistic because, for the most part, when it seems to, history has shown when there seems to have been an improvement in something, wouldn't you know it? Okay, we can vote now. We have all these different people in political office now. We can all go to school together now. We can do this and that together now. So that's from one angle point, that's an improvement. But at what cost are we really looking at? So I just have learned to, you know, to deal with Trojan horses in a certain kind of way, because it sure doesn't look good when you see it on the surface. But we as a people have to really begin to dig deeper into some of this stuff and really look at what's real. What is it really yielding, you know, in the big scheme of things? And that's why I love these kind of dialogues, my sister. I love the work that we are now doing because it demonstrates that, you know, this is what's happening. This is where our people are. This is where we're now going. We are now, you know, enough of us, let's put it that way, are now looking at things and saying, oh, yeah, okay, cool, that's happening. Yep, mm-hmm. But let me tell you, get the microscope out, okay, because surely from a historical perspective, this system has never intentionally or otherwise tried to do anything that was to our best interest.
Well, I don't think there's any argument for that. I think what's interesting is, to bring it back to the issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we as a community, and this is, of course, very theoretical on the one hand,
mm-hmm.
very
mm-hmm.
philosophical, and if we as a community would decide to address this in some solution-oriented ways as a community,
yes,
then that would, I think, you know, we're mortals, we don't have superpowers, be our best antidote to what you're talking about, to the institutional,
mm-hmm.
to the institutional dynamic, let's say. Because I don't think there's no argument to what you're saying. So, but the thing is, we're not taking care of business. And
that's
during,
right.
you made a reference
that's
to going
right.
to school together, and I think those of us in our generation know that it was a good idea to get rid of Jim Crow. However, and, you know, nothing is perfect. Again, we're humans, and we're inherently
right.
here to
right.
grow and evolve. But that we seem to have largely, black people in America, lost the sense of internal kind of community quality control,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
Not that there wasn't abuse and stuff going on, blah, 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 but that things were handled internally, first of all, because we were way more cognizant of the system, and the system was blatantly hostile and, you know, dangerous.
Right.
It's still blatantly hostile and dangerous, but we're kind of, like you said, there's kind of a buffer attitude. But, again, if we're not protecting our own, if we're not protecting our own women, our own children, our own men.
That's right.
Our own boys.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And all kinds of abuse. I mean, all kinds of abuse are abuse, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so we take it back to they're toxic, they're dysfunctional, and they go and they set up generational cycles.
Mm-hmm.
You set up generational cycles, which people repeat either outwardly. You know, either you become the type of abuser, the abuse you experience, or you tend to go in the other direction, but then you have to still do your own healing. You can internalize it, but then often you have to do your own healing. So you see people all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, and so as a community, I mean, if I had, you know, a fantasy or a wish, I'd say, well, let's take responsibility for our own healing, and that taking it back to the concept of the Sister for Sister Empowerment series and the books, that's kind of our premise that we're all writing from is let's heal ourselves, black people. Come on. Let's address our issues. Let's take all the power, all the education, all the brilliance, all the talent, all the ingenuity that we have, and let's heal ourselves. Let's heal ourselves and each other somehow. So while we're using fiction, which is, of course, fantasy to an extent, obviously we're making up stories, but we're all writing from the same premise, and that's what these books are about, is we're all writing, it's kind of we're wishing, you know, it's kind of like, okay, if I have a wish, here's how can we, on the ground, real people, we don't have the superpowers, as you're saying, the institutions at best can help a few people and at best might be neutral, but you know, can be more an enemy than anything.
Mm-hmm.
Well then, hey, this is up to us. It's, you know, what I like about your group and the work you do. This is up to us. Period.
That's
these
right.
are our families, our women, our children, our men and our boys, because we have to remember that even my father, what I learned when I was growing up, when I was an adult, and that my father had been abused. But I wasn't surprised because that was when I really, the light bulb went on about the cycles. Well, he is dead by then. I couldn't talk to him. But that the cycles go on for generation after generation after generation unless and until somebody consciously and deliberately works to break the cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other thing
that's
so insidious about all these different kinds of what I call intimate violence or abuse. Right?
Mm-hmm.
They go on and they go on and they go on. And, you know, research has proven that over and over again. And so, for instance, you know, you got a kid who watches mommy, daddy beat mommy or mommy beat daddy. Right? So there's a good chance the kid is either going to internalize it and become self-destructive.
Right.
Become
yep.
self-destructive.
Mm-hmm.
And or become an abuser or attract abusive relationships themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because that pattern is in their subconscious.
That's right.
So if you look at Chris Brown or Rihanna and take away who we think they are as, you know, young, beautiful, very talented people, and look at them as the latest generation of what is probably many, like for most of us, many generations of cyclical abuse, they were acting out the scripts with which they were programmed in their families of origin. It doesn't make them a good person, a bad person, or even
that's
a villain
right.
or a victim. In fact, I have a girlfriend who used to be an advocate for abused women. And the most shocking thing I saw when I went to visit her office, all these sisters, mostly black women, were advocates for women who had experienced domestic violence. You know, they would go with them to court. They would help them through if they wanted to report it, you know, that all that process. And this shocked me because I'd never experienced this concept before. A big old poster that said, in this office of women who were advocates for women and children, well, women really, experiencing domestic violence, there are no victims, only volunteers. There are no victims, only volunteers. Now, you wouldn't expect to see that in their office. They're advocates
right.
for women who are victims.
Right.
And I said to
right.
the woman who's, I said, whoa, that's kind of, wow, I don't know, really? You know, I was like, ah, oh. I was shocked. But I was like, whoa, you got to explain that to me. And she did.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay. And I understood. My mother wasn't physically abused by my father because she refused to be a victim. She also ended the relationship,
mm-hmm.
the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and this was the love of her life, so it could not have been an easy decision. Okay, she really, truly, genuinely loved him. He really, truly, genuinely loved her. He was not a healthy man. He wasn't able
right.
to have a healthy relationship with anybody. And the woman
right.
he stayed with for, I don't even know how many years, I mean, I guess 30, 40 years. My mother always told me she uses the woman he left my mother for when they broke up, but he tried to have both of them, and my mother was like, no, you got to go. But apparently, my mother swears when she was young, she was very pretty, his wife, till the end. But by the time I met her, at 4 or 5 years old, she looked like a punching bag.
Mm.
And I would say, and I was like, she was like, well, your dad beats her. It's like, oh, okay, that's why she looks like that. Now I'm 5, 6 years old. So, and I was like, well, did he beat you? No, I didn't let him. So do you see what I mean? So I knew
yeah.
I could be that kind of woman. So there's all that. So if you've experienced it, you tend to subconsciously attract it.
Mm-hmm.
Subconsciously, you attract it. You repeat we repeat patterns from our childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it has to be addressed there too. And that's what I think is the hardest
yeah.
to address, because that's not something that shows up on a police report.
Right.
You know.
You know, this is why this type of dialogue, I think, is so important and so powerful, because we're able to talk about it, and I think we're able to examine it and to really kind of break it down so that we can do the work that is necessary. I mean, you hit on so many different aspects of this, you know, just in this short period of time, and it's got my head going, I'm just really, you know, reviewing all of it and seeing something different, or, you know, something else comes to mind. And also to go back for a moment on one of the characters that the relationship of someone that you knew.
Mm-hmm.
It, when you said it, it reminded me so much of something else. That being when you talked about the sister who had the Ethiopian friend who she would beat the girls up over
yeah.
him.
Many
and
girls.
That was her way.
Yeah.
And that was her way of saying she's fighting for the. And I'm
yes.
sitting there going, wow. You know, I'm thinking about that and then remembering, you know what? I know some folks kind of like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm thinking about, from another angle, I'm thinking, you know what? Here it is, what we're talking about. We have got to help provide or help to folks, our sister in particular, to become familiar with tools
mm-hmm.
to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Because from that example, what I'm hearing is, I am frustrated. I am off. You know, I don't really know what to do to deal with this situation. I want my relationship, and I'm just going to deal with it the best way I know how.
Mm-hmm.
Because of lack of tools.
Yeah.
To know what to do, how to do it, or, you know, some other possibilities to obtain the same results or a better result.
Right, because some people could say, well, she was very, and she really was, in her own way, she was being solution-oriented. Because
right.
in her mind, the problem is, you know, these women, or these bitches, as she would say, and who were after my man. And I said, yeah, but your man is with them. he's the common denominator. She wasn't feeling me at all. She thought I was crazy. I thought she was crazy. But our men were friends, and so we spent a lot of time around each other, you know. But I would just look at him, and she'd be out of the room, and I said, "You're just a dog." And he'd go, "Hey, hey, hey, hey." I said, "Yeah, but she's beating people up. She's going to get arrested at some point. You know, she's going to, at some point, or she's going to kill somebody, or I don't know, or somebody's going to hurt her back." I mean, I was just seeing nothing but disaster. He thought it was, you know, his 21-year-old, however old he was, ego. Come on, you know. He was loving it, so it turned him on. And he would say, she really loves me. And that reminded me of my friend saying to me at 13 years old, "If he doesn't hit you, he doesn't love you."
Wow.
Okay, that was, to me, that came from the same school of logic, right?
Mm-hmm.
That violence and love are somehow inseparable, and that violence somehow is a demonstration of true love.
Mm-hmm.
But
that reminds me of the movie, Tina Turner's thing.
What's all got to do with it? But, I mean, there are people, even when you were talking earlier, we were talking about, and I know that, you know, everybody has their position on spanking, corporal punishment, right? But, again, I love the child, so I'm beating them, okay? I love the child, so I'm spanking him or her. Now, again, not arguing whether it's right or wrong, but you can see how that that rationalization. But people really, if you really believe that, are you a bad person?
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I mean? If you really truly believe that what you're doing represents love, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are you a bad person? Are you a villain? And so, we're talking about, we're in a constantly shifting. You know, because we're humans, and we're always evolving. But are you a villain if it's coming from what you define as a place of love, or in a relationship? I'm fighting for my relationship with your kids. I beat them because I love them and I want them to turn out right, and I don't, you know, and I want them to understand the lesson, right?
Right.
So there's that rationale there. There's, if he doesn't beat you, he doesn't love you. There's, I'm fighting for my relationship. And again, you could have seen this woman. Her name was Marilyn. I don't even remember her last name. I recognized, even because I really thought she was insane, but I saw, as I tried to understand her, because I've always been a writer, and to be a writer, you have to get inside of other people's heads who are not like you and try to understand them. And so I thought of her a lot when I was creating Monique, because, you know, and I remember even then thinking, yeah, but in a way somebody could say she's a problem solver. If the problem is these women coming after my man, and, you know, we think about it. There are more sophisticated versions of what Marilyn did. We all know women who are with men who cheat, and they deal with it, and sometimes they deal with it. They'll call, go through his phone. They'll call, "Who are you?" "Well, I just want you to know I'm his wife, and we've got 4 kids, and you're just one of 100,
right.
And, you know.
Right.
So they're not beating them up, but they're still confronting them, and in their mind, they're doing what they think they have to do, or they're doing the only thing they know how to do to save their relationship. I'm not saying they're doing the right thing or the wrong thing.
Right.
Right? And then there's the always or often tragic, you know, breakup, especially with often an emotionally or physically abusive guy, often. If, you know, if I can't have you, nobody can have you. Mentality that often leads to death.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah, that
if I can't have you, nobody can have
deadly.
You. Yeah, we've seen that a lot of times, you know, even from guys who haven't previously been abusive. So, you know, the risks are crazy. So what we try to do with my Blue Suede Shoes, like I said, is each of us, as you can tell from the descriptions of each story, each of us authors took a very different kind of abuse. Like, we kind of assigned them to ourselves or to each other. And said, okay, I'm going to write about this, I'm going to write about that. But each one of them looks at cycles and patterns in families or in the individual's lives, you know, who are in the story. So we wanted to all look at kind of, where does this abuse come from? Or let's say verbal and emotional abuse. And, you know, that's a hard one to kind of prove. Like, if you're with someone, if you're male or female, doesn't matter, and same-sex couples, whatever, if your partner is really critical of you, right? Is that abuse? If they're always really critical of you. But they're doing it out of love. You see what I mean? Or if they're, you know, always kind of insulting you. But I'm doing this for your own good. What is that? You know what I mean? So I think that's where it's very slippery and very subtle. When, you know, having a black eye or getting your butt beat, that's not slippery or subtle. That's obvious. It's visual. It's physical. It's documentable. You could take it to the police station. They can, like Rihanna. Because that whole story, remember, didn't escalate till that picture of her got out.
Right.
And you're looking
right.
at this gorgeous, sexy, hot, young, top-of-the-chart singer, right? With her ass whooped on her gorgeous little young face, all torn up. Okay. And so you go, oh, my God, he's a monster. And I'm not saying he wasn't a monster. I'm not saying what he did wasn't monstrous. Okay. But that picture, once we had a visual, we didn't even really care about the details of what happened. We saw that picture. So you can see that. You can't see sexual abuse. You can't see the other kinds of abuse in the same way. So we wanted to explore those. We wanted to look at healing, and we wanted to bring a little fun to it because, you know, it's like a sugar-coated vitamin, Empress. You know what that's like. We wanted to get people to read the book and to consider and discuss these things for themselves, whether or not they're directly affected. Because think about it. Between these just we only explored four kinds of abuse. There are many, many more we could have explored. Every single person who reads the book is going to have had some kind of exposure or experience to somebody who's played a role in these kinds of dramas. Everybody. You know somebody. Even if you don't know, you know it. You know what I mean?
Right. That's right.
You know? Have you ever known somebody who got raped and then they told people and then they realized how many other women have been raped? But they might have known each other for years and been really close friends or even family, but nobody ever said anything, and then they're like, the other one's just like, me too.
Right.
So we kind of wanted to have some me too come out of my blue suede shoes. So and also to go, oh, my God, that's crazy, because there's some pretty extreme stuff in our book, you know, but it's all stuff that happens every day. Unfortunately, sadly, and tragically, it's all stuff that happens every day. So you have two things about child abuse. So what you don't have in our book is the traditional woman having her butt beat by her man story. I just realized that as I was talking to you. We don't have that, but, and I think for a lot of reasons. I think because that one, and it's not that it's not worth exploring. And maybe if we had had five contributors, another one would have dealt with it. I think when we were coming up with our stories, we were trying to be creative and somewhat to look at things through a different kind of lens than you usually see. And that's the story you see in most stories, right? In most movies, in most TV shows, it's a woman having her butt beat by her man, not just a man, her man, you know? So we kind of wanted to get a little bit away from that. But understanding that the core dynamic and all of these things, it's all one thread, isn't it? It's all
one
thread. And I'm not sure we completely understand it, but I think we need to start trying to understand it.
Yes, and that's where we're at with it. And that's why, again, you know, all the various things that are coming forward to help us to look at this thing closer and to really just help to break it down to the point where we can just begin to put these things into the perspective that's necessary, because it's so much. And we have to take the time to categorize it and to really, you know, just examine it to the fullest extent possible. And we're the ones that have to do that because, you know, as we have often talked about on our meetings, our teleconference meetings, is that no one knows us better than we.
Right.
You couldn't possibly. I don't care how much research they've done on us for the past 500 plus years. No one knows our experiences better than we.
Yeah, and our experiences are complicated. So everything we go through is complicated by being black in America, is complicated by our history, is complicated by the fact that most of us are not voluntary immigrants to this country or culture.
Right?
Exactly.
Right. No doubt.
Yeah,
so
we have multiple layers on top of the already complicated, crazy layers.
Yes, yes.
You know?
Undoubtedly.
And yet, like you, I retain a sense of hope and optimism. I'm, you know, I love that line from Daughters of the Dust, is we are the children of those who chose to survive. And I think that's very powerful, because if you think about it, who survived the Middle Passage? Who survived slavery? You know, I believe in things like ancestral energies,
yes,
and cellular
indeed.
Memory and all of that. We've talked about, you know, post-traumatic slave syndrome. That's all very real to me, all very, very real to me. I feel the connections, I think we all do very strongly, and I feel very guided by them and very nourished by them. And you think about the fact that we're here despite everything. I mean, if you really lay out everything just statistically, girl, that we deal with, all of us, right, on a daily basis, it's a miracle. I tell people all the time, it's a miracle we're not just all crazy, like, you know, running down the streets naked with Uzis, just shooting everything we see, right? And that's why I tell my kids, Black people are amazing. Black people are amazing, you know, right? We're here.
No,
we're standing up straight. Our teeth are brushed. We go outside. We got our clothes on. We have a job. We go to school. I consider every single act of normalcy and progress, so to speak, a miracle. Don't you? If you really think about it, you described so brilliantly just a little while ago the institutional and systemic net that is just clawing at us. And that really we feed, you know, the whole cradle to prison pipeline, obviously, and all of its offshoots. And you're absolutely right. It's not, there's nothing benign about it. Okay, let's not, we're not, and we know that. But I just occasionally have to pause and marvel at our brilliance and at our resilience and at our strength and our genius. And I believe, because I have to believe this, so I'm not running naked down the middle of the street with the Uzi. Okay, frothing at the mouth crazy, because I think that's the alternative. I really believe we are here to heal. I really believe we have that ability. I really believe we have that responsibility to our ancestors and to our children, right? That we are, come on, we're compared to many Black people around the world, even though it doesn't seem like it, we're wealthy. If nothing else in our options.
That's,
I mean,
cool.
Those of us who've been able to travel, you go to another travel and you look at poverty, and you're not just like, well, you could go to welfare on welfare and get some food stamps, girl. You're looking at families sitting on a sidewalk every day.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
So I'm not saying there isn't a whole lot of improvement to be made, but I really believe, like I said, first of all, I have to just to be sane, but I really, really believe in us. And I believe we are really phenomenal. You know,
yes,
and that's what guides my blue suede shoes, that love and that really strong sense of, y'all, really, we just need to stop for a minute and really look at how magnificent we are.
Indeed.
Just to be here, right?
Absolutely.
Don't you think? Don't you think? I mean, you got a million women together. Like, you
too,
just
actually.
Woke up one morning. But no, you just woke up one morning, you know, as you were brushing your teeth or making your breakfast or whatever. And you said, you know, Farrakhan did it. I think I can do it too. Right? Is that at some level what happened? I think I'll just have a million. Come on. And I do want to interview about you and write an article about you, by the way. But did you just wake up one morning with your granola or your whatever you eat in the morning and go, you know, it's Tuesday. But you did it. And you've been doing it ever since. What is this, 14 years later? I'm not good at math, right? 16 years later, right?
Well, it's actually 16 from the Million Man March, but did start right after the Million Man March. I haven't really released the truth yet about, you know, certain things.
Okay, well, but you have to give me an interview when you're ready to release it. But listen, and this is my favorite word for Black people and Black Americans in particular, how audacious are you? You had the audacity to wake up in the morning. Audacious. You had the audacity. That's why it was a good word for Barack Obama, because it resonated with other uppity Negroes like us. And you had the audacity to just wake up in the morning and you were brushing your teeth and whatever and said, I'm a million women, silly. Yeah, I can do that. What?
Well, my sister, I'm going to hold on the answer because that answer right there is definitely going to require a lot more time than we
but
had.
But you're
going
to give it to me, promise. I want you to promise in front of
Dr.
your family.
Yes, yeah, Dr. Smalls is waiting to come on, but sister, certainly
okay.
I want to thank you. You got
yes.
to come
my
back.
My blue suede shoes.
We talking about your book or not, we got you got to come
no,
back.
No, you know what I want to do.
And your spirit is. You know, I am so appreciative of it.
Oh, thank you. Well, I just want to issue an invitation for all your listeners to read it, and then we can have, like, a book club meeting on the air.
Oh, okay. That will do. But for now, when is it coming out, and how can
my Blue Suede Shoes, you can, of course, you can get it on Amazon. It should be in your bookstores. But come, go to our website, which is empowerourselves.org. Empowerourselves.org. Find us on Facebook, My Blue Suede Shoes. And, or it's empowerful. Anyway, I'll tell you about Facebook next time, but I'm a little tired. But we're getting all that together. So it officially drops in 2 weeks. But you can pre-order on Amazon. We're a Black Expressions main selection, which is really a great honor, the Black Selections book, Black Expressions Book Club. We're a main selection for March. And so what everybody who listens to you, because you've got the gold standard of listeners people here, so you've got who we really want reading this book, and who we want to hear their candid opinions.
Okay.
And I'll make sure my co-authors are on with me. They're all, like, traveling and out
great.
Of pocket right
we'll
now.
We'll do a follow-up, and
yes.
we'll proceed and
let's
make
talk about this.
That we wonderful. Wonderful.
And talk about
that's
how we can heal,
good.
And maybe somebody can win a pair of blue suede shoes.
I know that's right.
Yeah, because we'll be offering some.
And with that, kick the system where it needs to be kicked.
Kick the system with our blue suede pumps, baby. That's what I'm talking about. All right. My blue suede shoes. Thank you.
All right, my sister. Thank you. Family, we have been talking with Sister Teresa Stovall, who is one of the co-authors of the new book, My Blue Suede Shoes. And as you could tell, this is all the way live, and I love it. And sister, again, thank you for helping us to observe our type of Women's History Month, which
absolutely.
We do every day anyway, but nevertheless,
yeah.
You know, and I certainly look forward to talking with you again on our regular weekly teleconference meeting as we really, I mean, family, we're making such a tremendous headway in a short period of time in addressing this issue of violence and abuse of our women and girls. And I want to thank Sister Teresa and those who have continued to call in weekly. Thank all of you. And we're going to keep on moving on.
All right. Well, good night. Thank you. And Ashe to everyone.
All right, sister. Thank
you. Okay. Thanks, bye.
Okay, moving right along, as we said earlier, we are going to talk now, we're going to kind of shift things a bit. We just talked with, of course, Sister Teresa Stovall, and again, we thank her for calling in and for sharing a lot of good information with us. We're just going to kind of flip the switch a little bit. We're going to extend our show for tonight because we felt it was very important to do so. You know, there's so much going on in the world today, and certainly Africa is in a lot of folks' minds. Unfortunately, it's in the minds of folk who really could care less about Africa in itself except for the continual rape of our homeland, of our motherland. But there are some things going on there that is a bit more relevant to us in some other kinds of ways. Over the years, Africa's people, children, us, meaning, we've created allies. We've created associations and partnerships and other kinds of collaborations with people who understand and overstand what we've gone through here in this country and throughout the diaspora. It just so happened a place like Cuba has been distinctively one of those locations, and of course has always been under attack as such. but also there are places in Africa that may not be as directly connected to our heritage or lineage as we may know of it, but yet still have maybe some indirect, if not direct, a connection. Now, certainly from a evolutionary-revolutionary standpoint, we have had folk who, again, have understood what it is to be self-determined and have supported that. Well, certainly you have heard what's going on in Libya. And certainly what you have heard is probably not half of what's really going on. Well, what we're going to do tonight in the rest of our show, and we are, again, extending our show for half an hour, but we just want to kind of give you a brief insight into what we're going to talk about tomorrow. Tomorrow at 3 o'clock, we want you to tune back in. And remember, any show that we air, once we air it, you can hear it anytime. So if you aren't able to tune in tomorrow, you can still hear the show by just going to the on-demand portion of our program. Go to New Day Resurrection and Liberation tomorrow or anytime. But tomorrow at 3 o'clock, we're going to do a special edition to focus on what's going on in Libya and why. Who and what is really behind what's going on in Libya. But for tonight, we are so blessed and honored to have what I feel is one of my elders and certainly one of our, you know, international scholars, for me, even more so, freedom fighter, okay, who has always shown a certain type of integrity and a certain type of just tenacity in dealing with true liberation for our people on a global scale. It was a pleasure to speak with him today, and in doing so, we came to the conclusion that we really need to stay on top of what's going on in Libya, and certainly to make certain that you, our extended family, are able to voice your opinion and your concerns. So with that said, we're going to go back to our live line, and we're going to begin a dialogue somewhat tonight. We're not going to go into having you to call in. We just want to hear the report and the assessment from our Dr. James Smalls. But tomorrow, we invite you to tune back in at 3 o'clock, same time, same location, same number, which I'm going to give out again shortly, and join us for the dialogue on what is really going on in Libya and why. We want to really capitalize what we know is happening, okay? Not just what is put out on your news, you know, and CNN and all these other people, but from a black perspective, from an African perspective. We want to talk about it, dialogue about it, and find out if there's anything possibly we need to be doing about it. So without further ado, we're going to go to our live line, and joining us now is our brother, our elder, Dr. James Smalls. Greetings, brother. Are you there?
Yes, my sister, I'm here, and greetings to you, and happy Women's Month to all of my sisters and mothers and daughters across the world.
Yes.
You know,
I want to thank you for calling in tonight. I know it's late, and I know you've had a busy day. You're at the ASCAT conference for this week.
Yes,
and
ma'am.
Hopefully you'll be able to give us a little overview on that, too. But by all means, you got it. It's your mic.
It's our people need to remember that we were tricked into a war in Iraq against a nation that did not fly the planes into the World Trade Center, tricked into a war to believe they had weapons of mass destruction and to prove they had no weapons of mass destruction. And as a result of going into that war, our government in our name and dropping all the smart bombs and slick bombs and super bombs killed in our name. They murdered in our name nearly 600,000 Iraqi men, women, and children, civilians. And we have to go before God and live with that. They're also responsible for nearly, I guess, something like about 10 to 12,000 deaths in American young men and women who went faithfully to serve in our military to protect our country, but were used as mercenary of the corporate structure to commit murder in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
They're responsible for the crippling of over 60 to 70,000 of our young teenagers, men and women, who volunteer to serve our country in the name of a lie, using the media to create a false image of Iraq, to vilify the ruling people in Iraq, then to go in and to murder those people to get access to the oil for the world corporate oil giants. And we're still stuck in Iraq, spending billions of dollars of our tax money every week and wondering why we have an economic crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So here we go again. The false vilification of Mr. Gaddafi and the government of Libya, and now acting on a what is nothing more than a coerced phony vote of the United Nations, we're going to go in again with our military to commit murder in the name of the American citizen who you bamboozle with your lies fed to the press. You know, Libya has not committed any crimes against our country. They're not a military or any other kind of threat against American sovereignty or American national interest. Mercenaries financed by Britain, France, and maybe even America, and maybe even Israel, invaded Libya, hiding behind a so-called protesters, many of whom were paid to go in the streets, many of whom were Egyptian immigrant nationals and Palestinian nationals in Libya. And then behind that, you bring a mercenary armed group that tried to overthrow the government who failed. And because they failed to carry out your dastardly crime, now we've got to commit our financial resources and our military to complete the crime that your mercenaries couldn't complete. And again, jeopardizing American lives and American wealth to commit murder in the name of the American citizens who you use the media to fool into thinking you're fighting against terrorists. And so you're going to invade France, America, and Britain, a sovereign nation state who have the right to protect itself against any insurgency that's trying to overthrow them under the guise that you're going to protect the citizens of Libya. Well, when you bombed the Congo after murdering Patrice Lumumba, you said you went to protect the civilian nuns who were under threat in the Congo. When you bombed Grenada and invaded it, you said you went to protect American students in a medical school. And here you go with your lies again, and here go the American people being bamboozled and tolerating it once again without saying anything. I just want to register, sister, with God and the universe, that I did not accept the lie and that I did not keep my mouth shut. When God judged me, know that I spoke up on behalf of justice and what's right. It is criminal what the UN has done as regards Libya. It is also criminal what our nation and our leadership is doing in the crimes they're now committing against Libya and the government and the people of Libya. It is criminal what France and Britain are doing, since they were definitely behind the mercenaries and insurgents that tried to overthrow that government and fail. And are they going to murder President Gaddafi and murder his children like we murdered his younger children years ago in the name of a phony, I'm going to protect the citizen of Libya? And we as the American people, will we stand for it again? Well, Malcolm X told you, the chickens always come home to roost. And as we commit these crimes against other people, eventually those crimes will be committed against us.
That's right.
And I hope the American people this time don't stand for it. Send emails, send faxes to the White House, to the State Department, to Hillary Clinton, and said, we have not authorized you to commit murder in our name as citizens of America. And tomorrow I hope we will go into more detail so that the people can see that what happened in Egypt and Tunisia was really a game to get Mr. Gaddafi.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Mr. Ali in Tunisia was expendable. Nothing else has changed in Tunisia. The same group of criminals and bankers and corporate barons are running Tunisia. The same military that ran Egypt under Mubarak now runs Egypt with even a more iron fist. And the people of Egypt are now waking up and realize we've been bamboozled. Someone sent something over the internet about 2 weeks ago, a letter from the American Embassy in Egypt to, I guess, the State Department, letting them know that the young, some of the young people that they had brought to America in June, under the guise of speaking at a youth conference on democracy in Washington, had been stopped by the Egyptian authorities at the airport, and their notes and speeches were taken. But that the government only warned them and said, we are watching you. They thought their plan in Egypt had been uncovered, but unfortunately it wasn't. And so they were able to pull it off. But it was nothing but a smokescreen. Egypt and Tunisia was nothing more than a smokescreen for the crime that's now being committed in Libya. And I hope, America, that we don't fall for Iraq a second time.
Now, Dr. Smalls, when we spoke earlier, a couple of things, and we're going to elaborate more on this tomorrow when we have a real open forum and dialogue, but one of the things that we talked about today briefly was that contrary to popular belief, and we're going to get a little more into this tomorrow, General Gaddafi's, President Gaddafi's, shall we say, heritage background is not exactly what many may think in terms of, you know, from whence he really comes. In other words, in people that I've talked with over the years, you know, they tend to say, yeah, well, you know, it's just another Arab kind of thing, and therefore we need to be a bit more cautious of that. And, of course, again, contrary to popular belief, that's not just the case. Is that correct?
Well, the first thing, even if Gaddafi was an Arab, America, Britain, and France, and the criminals at the United Nations that voted for this action, have no right to invade a sovereign country that's doing no more than protecting its sovereign integrity from mercenaries and insurgents. But Gaddafi is an African Bedouin, and his matrilineal line is as black as any of us in America. And it was those same Bedouin families that Gaddafi comes from that waged war against the Arab invasion into North Africa for nearly 200 years. So if you want to know his pedigree, get it right.
That's right.
Mr. Gaddafi is the only nation in North Africa and the so-called Middle East who wasn't put there by Western imperialism. But they fought and won their own freedom from Western colonialists. And they're the only sovereign state in North Africa that can say, we are here by the sweat of our brow and by fighting for our own freedom. We were not put here by Britain, France, America, or any European state. We put ourselves here. And that's one of the reasons why they've always opposed Muammar Gaddafi. But Gaddafi has given more assistance to Africa, the rest of Africa, in terms of his combined effort than all of the European states combined, in terms of financial resources and other resources. He served as a member of the African, the OAU, and a member of the African Union. And he's been one of the far more champion of African unity in the United States of Africa, which may be one of the other reasons why they would like to remove him. Because the last thing the West would like to see is the United States of Africa. And the oil in Libya, which they would love to get, you know, Libyan oil has less sulfur than any other oil in the world. It requires less cleaning, and it costs less to bring it from the ground to the car than it costs to do any other oil in the world. But there are other things in Libya, including the sand. The sand in Libya has proven to be the best soil in the world to make fiber optics. But the big thing is that Gaddafi is not he's not a Mubarak who was put there by the West. He's not Saddam Hussein who was put there by the West. He's not the Tunisian leadership or the Saudi leadership or the Bahraini leadership. All of them was placed there by Western imperialism. Gaddafi is the only North African government that brought itself to governance by fighting for freedom against colonialism and European dominance. And so we need to wake up. If we continue to allow our government to commit genocide and murder in our name, then we have no complaints when the chickens come home to roost.
That's right. Now, one of the things that I felt was, you know, very heartfelt for me today is when you said that, at least for you, you could not rest, you know, comfortably or in any kind of way, really, if you had not spoke out and said something about this. And
yes.
I think that's what it really also comes down to, regardless if one feels that by sending an email or fax or whatever is going to stop them from doing, you know, what they have been planning to do for, to me, ever since made the announcement in the UN.
Yes.
But the point still being is that we still need to, at least in principle, say something, do something, make a statement.
If we believe in the God we say we believe in, if we believe in the humanity we say we believe in, if we believe in state sovereignty we say we believe in, if we believe in the democracy we say we believe in, we need to register that feeling with our government in the form of emails, in the form of faxes, in the form of Twitters, in the form of phone calls, to let them know you can no longer commit crime in our name and have us sit silently by. Even if we can't stop the crime, we can at least let you know that we do not support or endorse the criminal behavior on the part of our governments in order to support the corporate interests and other foreign governments' corporate interests in Africa. And today it's Libya. Tomorrow it will be Uganda. It will be Ghana. It will be Tanzania. It will be the Congo. It will be Nigeria. And they will use the same scenario, vilify the leadership, vilify the political organization, claim they're going to come in to help the poor African citizens. And we've been down that road too many times before.
So tomorrow, again, family, we hope that you will tune in at 3 o'clock when we bring a special edition of New Day Resurrection Liberation. We are going to have Dr. James Small joining us, and we're going to really go a bit more in depth into this whole issue of what's happening in Libya, but also the whole idea of what's going on, period, in the new takeover of Africa, which, of course, is happening right before our eyes. And that's really, really what it's all about. So, again, tune in tomorrow. We will open up the phone lines for your comments. And also, if you want to engage in the dialogue, the number that you're going to call into tomorrow is 646-652-2232. Again, 646-652-2232. We're going to also have the chat room open so that you can do your posting and dialoguing through the chat. If you have questions, you can also post them there. But we're going to have a very candid and very powerful and serious dialogue tomorrow at 3 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Again, we invite you to join us. And if you can't, you will be able to hear a rebroadcast at any given time by just going to the on-demand section, and you'll be able to, you know, hear what we talked about and so forth. Dr. Flaws, I mean, there's so much that we can say about this, but I have to ask you this because we were talking about it earlier. Did you hear that there were women in Egypt that called for a Million Woman March on March the 8th?
I know it's going to happen. But I first heard it, I was like, wow, yes.
This was not what I did on February 28th.
No, when I told you I'd heard about this.
Right.
I heard about it as we got to Egypt. I thought it was a part of your effort once you mentioned it to me, but it was the Egyptian woman that I heard. And I think, you know, my sister, the men have had an opportunity to run this world into the ground, to cause the death of so many of the children that you produce unnecessarily. And I think the mothers of the world have to stand up and take control of the affairs of this world. There's more women on this planet than men. As a spiritual species, you certainly have more power than men. Men have lost the right to talk about human integrity, given the genocide they've wreaked over the centuries. And I hope there's a million women march in every nation in the world, particularly starting with Africa and the so-called Middle East. Stand up and assume the role of the mothers of this world. And let the men of this world know you have no access to me unless you conduct yourself in a manner that would be honored by the divine itself.
That's right.
When women exert that kind of power, the primitive criminal male behavior might begin to mature into civilized men.
Ashe. Well, we're going to talk more about that tomorrow as well, because, again, the official announcement was made at the UN on February 28th, which marked actually the 14th year from the initial announcement being made in 1997. I made it on February 28th of 1997, so that's why this February 28th was selected to announce that we are indeed on our way to Africa in 2012. We felt very fortunate to hear that the women have already began to pick up the mantle, as they did at the UN, you know, roughly 12 countries.
Remind you of something, sister. You know, the liberation movement in Africa, which was triggered right after the First World War, was not triggered by the men of Africa, but it was triggered by the market women of Nigeria and of Ghana. They're the one that triggered the Pan-African movement and the liberation movement. It was taken over by the men, but it was triggered by the resistance of the women merchants who did not want to be taxed by the British colonizers. And they took to the streets and started fighting. You understand? And as the woman triggered the Pan-African movement and the liberation movement in Africa, I think it's going to take the women again to trigger the new liberation movement of the human spirit now, except this time, don't hand the scepter to the male. He either come in as a partner or he should remain a subordinate.
I know that's right.
I'm speaking the truth as I understand it. I'm not trying to display to you because you're a woman. But I look at the world. I'm a father of women. And I see the crime that's committed against the women that I produce and the crime that have been committed against my sibling females. And if men don't start standing up against the crime that we commit against the women in this world, then the women have a right to treat us like the criminals that we are.
That is explicitly clear. And also may I add that those who know you or know of you know that you're not one to patronize or to bite your tongue. So you certainly just have to say to me that you're not saying that because I'm a woman. I think the respect for you is certainly, you know, in our community nationwide. So it goes without saying. But I'm hoping that you will be in the States in October, because certainly I would love to have you at our first Africana Women's Power Summit that's going to happen in recognition of the 14th year anniversary of the Million Woman March, which is going to also serve as a planning session to get us ready for 2012. So I'm hoping that
yes,
you will be
once
able
you
to
let
come.
Me know the date, I will make
okay.
sure I schedule myself to be here.
All right. We will do that without a doubt. All right, family, we're down to our last few minutes. So, again, we remind you, tomorrow, 3 o'clock, we will be here live and in living color. New Day Resurrection and Liberation will bring you a special segment. We invite you to call in, to tune in. And again, we do so with you to have the intent, rather, to take action. Our radio dialogue is not just about a lot of conversation, a lot of rap and clap. It's really designed for a proactive stance. So, with that said, please tune in tomorrow, 3 o'clock, special edition, Libya and Africa, period, will be the topic. Your candid views are welcome. We don't, you know, flower stuff up for you. We're not here for that and have never done that and never will. We'll go up there first before we do that, so you feel free to voice your opinion. Again, we will be joined with Dr. James Small. If you're not familiar with him, you will be tomorrow. In fact, we're going to give you a little video kind of thing, just in case you're not, for tomorrow, for those of you who might be new listeners or just coming into certain kinds of activities, just so you'll know. But we will be back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Dr. Smalls, your final comments for tonight?
That we should always remember the old song, that before I be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go
Ooh.
Home to my divine God and be free. And do not allow anyone to commit crime in the name of the citizens of America without at least speaking out against the criminal and the criminal behavior of those who would dare to say they're acting in our name and yet act against the interests, both ethically, morally, and principally, of the government of the United States and the people of the United States. And thank your audience very much, my sister. Ma'at Hotep.
Mahotep, as we say. Now, before you leave, Dr. Smalls, I would be remiss. I almost forgot. We do have a few more minutes for that. You are at the ASCAT conference in D.C.
Yes.
But before you give us a brief report on that, there's one thing I feel I need to say, and that is for those who say they are about the struggle or the movement or liberation or whatever you care to call it, remember that if we do not stand up with and for our allies, and also for our freedom fighters, beating political prisoners and those that are on the front line, then we are not who we say we are.
Dr. King said it very simply. Either you stand for something or you will fall for anything. You know, and I think that was so aptly put. Either you stand for something or you will fall for anything. And our community in America is the most active Christian community in the world. Well, if we truly believe in the Christ consciousness and in the Christ personality, then stand up for what Christ would stand up for. Don't stop being hypocrites and don't allow yourself to be lied to. Let Christ be your litmus. If Christ would not support that, don't you support it. If you just take that as your measuring, hey, there'll be no problems in your life.
And
Malcolm taught us
will...
the secret to life is to have no fear. The secret to life is to have no fear. You know.
And again, tomorrow we will go more into this conversation, this dialogue, as we talk more about what's happening in Libya and why. Now, a few minutes to just kind of recap on the conference for this weekend.
Right. The ASCAT conference, the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilization, had an overwhelming turnout of thousands at Howard University this weekend. We started on Friday. We'll be culminating tomorrow, you know, with the closing speech by Dr. Leonard Jeffries and by Dr. Dudley Thompson. Dudley Thompson is 93 years old. He's the head of the World African Diaspora Union. He's a former Jamaican ambassador to Africa and to, I think, Britain. He is probably one of the last surviving members of the last Pan-Africanist conference in the 40s. And he's just an extraordinary man, and everyone knows Dr. Leonard Jeffries. Tonight, we listen to Dr. Francis Kress Welty lay things out on what the sociological effects of the things that's happening to our community, education-wise and economic-wise and political-wise in America today. And during the week, it was so beautiful. I didn't even deliver a paper at this conference. I came to hear our youth. Most of the papers were delivered by young African-American men and women, most of them under the age of 35, and they were extraordinary. Mathematicians, scientists, nutritionists, historians, archaeologists, anthropologists, and it was just an extraordinary event talking about the history and the lineage of African people, our contribution to world civilization, our contribution to building America, our contribution to building Europe, our contribution to building Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. It was just fantastic. Our contribution to building Greece, so that the Greek, what is called the Greek miracle, is really an African miracle or an African instruction to Greece. According to Plato and Herodotus and Homer and Aristotle, they all give Africa credit for what we know as Greece today. And so that discussion was fantastic all day, and it was beautiful to see our youth now standing up and taking the leadership role that some of us held for so many years. I was just overwhelmingly proud. And that this being spring break, we had nearly 500 to 600 college students who normally would have been on spring break, but they were at a conference on African civilization at Howard University. That
is a
statement that was fantastic.
Wow. Wonderful.
We should be proud. We are an extraordinary people. We are an African people. We are an African-American ethnic nation, and we should not be ashamed of that. We are also citizens of the United States of America, and we should not be ashamed of that, because most of the morality and the ethics and the civility of America was forced on it by the struggle of the African American.
Mm-hmm.
And we ought to be proud of that.
All right. All right, family, we are down to our last minute. And again, we want to thank Dr. James Smalls for taking the time out to join us tonight. And we will be back tomorrow, 3 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Please tune in, pass the word. We thank all of you for tuning in. Our numbers are each week increasing, steadily rising. We're moving into the thousands now worldwide. So we thank you again, Dr. Smalls. I look forward to talking with you tomorrow.
Thank you, my dear.
All
and
right.
Thank the community for letting us come into their consciousness and their minds.
Absolutely. Okay. My Hotep. All right, family, again tomorrow we will be here. Special edition of New Day Resurrection and Liberation. Until then, this is Empress Chi leaving you, of course, with the spirit and the concept of power, prosperity, and peace. And remember, there can be no Hotep without my eye. There can be no peace without justice. Until tomorrow, Pamoja Tradition Day. Together we shall win. Tutanana.